From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Every now and then in the news, there's a story about some horrible tragedy that happens to a group of children, maybe a fire at a nursery school, maybe an accident with a school bus. Writer Russell Banks used one of those tragedies as the basis for his new novel, The Sweet Hereafter. On this edition of Fresh Air, Russell Banks on what happens after a parent's worst fear comes true. Also today, crime novelist Carl Hiaasen tells us about the Disney world the Disney people don't want you to know about. And world music critic Milo Miles checks out the new album from the Caribbean dance band, The Burning Flames. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A senior Pentagon official has denied reports that U.S. warplanes are on the move to the Persian Gulf. There have been reports that the U.S. is mobilizing the military to enforce the United Nations resolutions against Saddam Hussein. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The senior Defense Department official who spoke on the ground he not be named said it was important to emphasize that no U.S. air units have done anything. Nothing has moved, said the official, and reports to the contrary are not true. Pentagon officials say they have made contingency plans involving U.S. forces to make Saddam Hussein comply with the U.N. Security Council resolution. Saddam has refused to allow unrestricted inspection flights of suspected nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons sites in Iraq. The senior Pentagon official said it may not be necessary to send any forces to Iraq if Saddam complies with the U.N. resolution and permits the inspections. But the official stressed it all hinges on Iraq. This is Brian Naylor at the Pentagon.
Iraq's representative at the International Atomic Energy Agency conference in Vienna charged today that the nuclear issue is being used as a pretext to maintain economic sanctions against his country. Ambassador Rahim Al-Kitai asserted that the United States and its allies have exaggerated Iraq's nuclear weapons potential as an excuse to punish the government of Saddam Hussein. Al-Kitai said that Iraq met UN deadlines for the disclosure of its nuclear programs, including its production of a small amount of plutonium. He noted that Iraq is the only one of the 115 members of the UN nuclear agency that has been censured for allegedly cheating on its safeguard agreement. Domestic policies are on the president's agenda as he tours the West. In Arizona and Utah, the president announced domestic policy initiatives. NPR's Howard Berkus reports.
The president has been accused of ignoring domestic policies, but this trip has several stops designed to highlight a domestic agenda. Today, the president talked about the environment and health care. At the Grand Canyon in Arizona, Mr. Bush watched as EPA Administrator William Riley formally accepted an agreement between a coal-fired power plant and environmentalists. The agreement is expected to reduce the air pollution that sometimes clouds scenic vistas in the Grand Canyon. Later in Salt Lake City, the president announced that 15 U.S. communities will split $25 million in an attempt to cut unusually high infant death rates. Included are Indian reservations in the Midwest and West, rural towns in the South, and neighborhoods in the nation's largest cities. I'm Howard Berkus with the president in Salt Lake City.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 5 points to close at 3,017.89. Advances edged declines by a slight margin in active trading. This is NPR News. France said today that it may recommend that a United Nations peacekeeping force be sent to Yugoslavia to end the fighting in Croatia. The proposal acknowledged the failure of the latest ceasefire brokered by the European Community. Yugoslavia's Federal Army and Navy were reported to be fighting Croatian forces in the Adriatic port city of Split. Croatia's defense minister resigned today after he was publicly rebuked by Croatian President Franjo Tudjman. The minister was accused of lifting a blockade on Federal Army barracks before the ceasefire went into effect. Strike-plagued Canadians are getting a break today. Federal civil servants who've been striking for 10 days went back to work this morning, and striking transit workers are expected back to work on Friday. From Toronto, Richard Reynolds reports.
The civil servants' strike was certainly causing the most consternation for Canadians. 115,000 striking federal employees had been joined by another 45,000 who were staging a work slowdown. traffic across the Canada-U.S. border had been slowed to a crawl, and Canada's most important airport saw dozens of flights canceled each day. The civil servants were striking to protest a government wage freeze, and while the government hasn't backed down, the two sides agreed to reopen negotiations next week. In Toronto, commuters have been without a transit system for the past week. 800,000 people who normally rely upon buses and subways to get them to work have been stranded. If a new contract is approved, however, Toronto could be back to normal by Friday morning. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds in Toronto.
There have been increasing calls in the Soviet Union for an open trial for those accused of plotting last month's coup against Soviet President Gorbachev. Part of the concern over openness stems from suspicions that Gorbachev himself may have had some role in the coup, either to discredit the hardliners or in the belief that they would support him. The Soviet prosecutor's office hasn't set a trial date or announced whether or not the trial will be open. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. It's hard to imagine anything more painful to a parent than the death of their child. Confronting such a loss is the central focus of a new novel from Russell Banks called The Sweet Hereafter. It's a story about what happens in a small community following a tragic school bus accident in which 14 children are killed. Banks says he wanted to deal with the aftermath of such a calamity more than the catastrophe itself. Russell Banks comes from Barnstead, New Hampshire, a small New England town similar to the one that provides the backdrop to The Sweet Hereafter. His previous novels include Affliction and Continental Drift. The story of the school bus accident is told through four different points of view, from the father of two of the kids who were killed, a negligence attorney from New York, and a teenage girl who survived the accident. The book begins with an account of the accident, as recalled by Dolores Driscoll, the driver of the bus, who's trying to remember how she lost control.
A dog. It was a dog I saw for certain, or thought I saw. It was snowing pretty hard by then, and you can see things in the snow that aren't there, or aren't exactly there. But you also can't see some of the things that are there, so that, by God, when you do see something, you react anyhow, erring on the distaff side, if you get my drift. That's my training as a driver, but it's also my temperament as a mother of two grown sons and wife to an invalid. And that way, when I'm wrong, at least I'm wrong on the side of the angels. It was like the ghost of a dog I saw, a reddish-brown blur much smaller than a deer, which is what you'd expect to see out there that early, although the same gingerbread color as a deer it was, moving fast behind the cloud of snow falling between us, then slow, and then stopped altogether in the middle of the road like it was trying to make up its mind whether to go on or go back. I couldn't see it clearly, so can't say what it was for sure, but I saw the blur clearly, that's what I mean to say, and that's what I reacted to. These things have to happen faster than you can think about them, because if they don't, you're going to be locked in place just like that dog or deer or whatever the hell it was, and you'll get smacked head-on the same as that dog would have if I hadn't hit the brake and pulled the wheel without thinking. But there's no point now to lingering over the dog, whether it was a dog or a tiny deer or even an optical illusion, which, to be absolutely truthful, now seems likeliest. All that matters is that I saw something I didn't expect out there and didn't particularly identify at the time, there being no time for that. So let's just say it was like a dog, one of those small red spaniels, smaller than a setter, the size of a kid in a rust-colored snowsuit. And I did what anyone with half a brain would have done. I tried to avoid hitting it.
Where did this idea of a small town dealing with a school bus accident in which many of the town's children die. Where did that idea come from?
God only knows where your sources really come from, but I am conscious of having read and being struck, having been struck by an article, in fact, a series of articles in 1989 and 90, early 90, concerning a small town, a Hispanic community in South Texas. You might remember the case where a school bus was nudged off the road by a Coke truck into a quarry, and a number of children were killed and so forth. But the articles that left me puzzled and saddened and, I guess, engaged were about the townspeople in that small, in South Texas town, where everybody ended up suing each other, countersuits were filed, people were ostracized, there was a kind of self-destructive operation going on following that accident. And I think in a way aggrieved over that at long range. And I couldn't write about a story about South Texas Hispanic community very well, but I live 6 months a year in upstate New York in the Adirondacks, and I know those people and grew up amongst people like that. So it wasn't too hard for me to translate over.
As a parent, can you contemplate anything more painful than losing a child when they're still young?
Well, no, that's, in fact, I probably couldn't have written. I have four children, and four daughters now grown. The youngest is 20. And I probably couldn't have written this book until recently, really, until I kind of stopped waking up in the middle of the night with those kind of cold sweats that a parent gets when you realize, my God, the terrible fragility of life, and especially of your child's life, and the terrible responsibility that you have for preserving that and protecting that. And you sort of superstitiously name the thing you're most frightened of, I suppose, and hoping that it'll go away if you can name it. And that might have been a motive, a deeper and more profound motive, personal motive for me to in the writing of the book, was now I was free enough to name the thing I've been most frightened of for 25 years. And I could encounter it this way without coming undone.
This seems like an unfair question to ask you, but I know that Sigmund Freud says that behind a fear is a wish.
Mm-hmm.
Can you contemplate that?
That's a hard one. You really threw a curveball at me with that.
I don't even know if I believe it.
Yeah. Well, what would be my wish in this case? I suppose there may be indeed, but behind the fear of the loss of your child is the wish for the loss of your child. Not that your child should die, but that you should be free of your child and free of this terrible responsibility that the child's existence places on you. And sure, there may be a bit of that as well operating. And so we bring to these occasions, some turbulent and powerful emotions, I think.
Do you think there's something about accidents or tragedies that create a kind of vividness of memory? As we meet your characters, mm-hmm. They remember the details mm-hmm. of the day, everything mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. they did, mm-hmm. Remembering it as if they are, in a sense, reliving it.
Yeah, when I was first researching the book, really, and trying to understand how I was going to get it, I knew I wanted to have it told in the first person by four different characters, picking up one after the other and continuing the story. But I wanted to find a kind of language which would be appropriate for this situation and for these people. And I have a friend who's a negligence lawyer, and Mitchell Stevens Esquire is not based on my friend, I hasten to add.
Lucky for him.
Lucky for me. But he provided me with some transcripts of depositions taken by parents who were bringing negligence suits, parents who had lost their children. And I was overpowered, really, by the by a couple of things, in particular by the precision, the care for the exact truth as they remember or understood it, and the details of the child's existence and daily reality and so forth. The absence of generalization. Everything seems incredibly concrete. On the one hand. And then on the other hand, there was a flatness of affect. Tonally, it was impersonal and flat. And the combination of the flatness and the precision of detail created a kind of rhetoric that I hoped to use as a model, tried to use as a model for my own style in this book, the language that I wanted to get at, and still make them distinct voices.
Russell Banks is my guest, and his latest book is called The Sweet Hereafter, and it's a novel, the story of a town in upstate New York that loses its children in a bus accident, and it's a story told through the eyes of several of the people who live in the town and who try to come to terms with this tragedy. One of your characters says, a town that loses its children loses its meaning. Does a town, this town called Sam Dent, New York, how does it need its children? How does a town need its children?
Well, it reaffirms, I suppose, the natural order of things. There's a kind of agreement made with the birth of a child in a family and in a town and in a country, in a nation, really, that that the child will outlive the parent. There's a natural order of things. Death comes, it comes inevitably, but it comes at the right time. And when it doesn't come at the right time, then it loses meaning. I mean, then life loses meaning. That disruption of the natural order. And I think that's what Billy Ansel, the character, was referring to there, is that loss of the natural order of things.
You grew up in a small town in New Hampshire, right. Barnstead, New Hampshire.
Yeah, how'd you know?
Banstead is what they say out there.
Right.
When you were young, did you feel your town needed you, as you have this character saying?
That's an interesting question. It's hard to say. I just had a funny experience. I don't know. This is maybe just a digression, but I went back and read at the town library where I went to high school, and about 40 or 50 of my classmates were there, and old high school teachers were there. And it was a public reading, and at a certain point in the Q&A period at the end, you know, where you usually get the serious literary questions, there, a woman stood up, an elderly woman in the back of the room, and she, I didn't know who she was. She said, "Russell, how's your mother?" It was one of those wonderful moments. I mean, it was like a plant. I wanted to take her around all over the country and put her in every audience for every Q&A. It just relaxed me. It relaxed the audience. Everybody laughed. And then we got a bunch of real questions, too. I mean, but I got to talk about my mother with her, which was nice.
So how is your mother?
She's fine.
Yeah. The digression, it is a digression, yeah, but it also, I think, really
yeah, I wanted to show talks about that connection was so comforting, you know, when she asked that personal, friendly, she knows I have a mother and she worried about her. She said, "I knew her in scouting," which meant I think they were scout mothers or something, yeah. And that made me at ease and feel like I had come home. Up to that moment, I hadn't felt quite that easy and secure.
Russell Banks is my guest, and his latest book is called The Sweet Hereafter, and it's the story of a small New York town's attempt to understand a tragic school bus accident in which a number of the town's children are killed. We're going to take a short break, and this is Fresh Air. Writer Russell Banks is my guest. I know a little bit about your life, and I know that your father was an alcoholic. He abandoned the family. He was abusive to you. Did your town protect you from him?
No, I can't say that they did, but I can't say that they had an opportunity to either, as most cases of this sort, domestic violence is a shameful secret that's withheld from the town. In the novel, in The Sweet Hereafter, there's a story that concerns the young girl, Nicole Burnell. I mean, the case of sexual abuse, and it's the family secret, and she can't. I tried to show how she couldn't betray the family publicly without doing a shameful thing and just sort of destroying that family. How could she maintain the family and still not humiliate herself? And she manages to find a way of acting out of her anger, of bringing her anger against her father to bear on her father's life in a way that only he and she know. And that was important for me to work that through, just to see how far I could go with that so that she could both be courageous and angry and could express that anger without destroying the unit to which she belonged and depended on so strongly, the family.
Were you actually able to do that in person, or did you have
these
characters
do that? No, I don't think I personally was able to do that at the time. I think most people are not. I didn't have enough wit, imagination, or perhaps circumstances where I could do it. The characters, yes, they probably do act in some ways as projections for us and live out some of our own needs and fantasies as well. But you don't know it at the time. I mean, when you look at it, I'm looking at it now a year later and looking back and saying, gee whiz, that's an interesting solution to her problem.
Wish I had thought of that.
Yeah, wish I had thought of that exactly.
Your relationship with your father, mm-hmm. I think many people who have been in abusive relationships, mm-hmm. whether it's physically or mm-hmm. sexually, what a child gets is a lot of attention.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of focus of this parent is on this child. Yeah. They are inflicting pain on them, mm-hmm. but they are in a sense, part of a center of someone's mm-hmm. life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a great deal
Did you have to come to terms with that?
I'm sure, yeah. I mean, I didn't ever go through a kind of psychoanalysis in order to deal with this myself. So, as a result, I probably spent many more years working through in small increments the aspects of this experience. And so I don't have, as a result, probably a very clear and coherent picture of how it occurred, because it happened in such small increments over so many years. But I know there is a kind of heat and light at the center of that kind of oppression or exploitation that creates in the child and later perhaps even in the adult. Well, certainly not perhaps, certainly in the adult, a bewildering kind of guilt for the pleasure that you took in being the center of the attention and being so dramatically utilized, really.
One of the things that your book seems to want to do is, or at least want to explain, is this urge to affix blame or affix cause and blame mm-hmm. to somehow, mm-hmm. in the face of tragedy, to try to put it into some mm-hmm. meaningful context. Do you think that's almost a human need? Or is that something, is there something almost very American about that?
Yeah, I think in a secular age and an age which believes so profoundly in cause and effect, it's shocking and disorienting to us when something comes along that seems to be a causeless event. We have no religious apparatus for dealing with that. We have no social or scientific way of dealing with that. And so it makes us feel a little mad, really. And I think that the need to affix blame is very powerful in that context.
Writer Russell Banks is my guest. You've had you've done many things besides writing.
Yeah.
When did you start to write? Were you avoiding it, or did you even know?
No,
you
No,
could?
I think that I was not able early on to realize that it was a possibility for me that you could actually make a life out of this silly thing of telling stories. Imagine that.
Was it a silly thing?
Well, it occasionally feels like that to me.
Every
now and then, yeah, something useful like pipe fitting. Every now and then I realize that, my God, I'm spending my life making up stories about people who don't exist and telling them to other people that I never meet. This is a rather peculiar way to live a life. Not by any means am I complaining, you understand. But to get back to your question, I did start writing more or less as a form of play and whimsy, just fantasy, really, when I was in my late teens and early 20s. I had thought at that time that I wanted to be a visual artist because I had a sort of a visible talent. I mean, it showed itself, and I could draw well. The hand could work. His eye-hand coordination wasn't bad when you put a pencil in it and put it on a page. But a literary gift isn't always that evident, and rarely that evident. So it was in my early 30s that I began to move from play to taking it fairly seriously and seeing what the possibilities were. And I think that had everything to do with that was the period in which I began to become a disciplined and a serious, even obsessive reader. So my involvement with reading really was what I think generated my sense of myself as a writer and made that possible for me.
You're the first in your family, I think, to go to college.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did your parents, did they have sort of aspirations for you of doing doing what they had not been able to do for themselves?
I think
themselves?
My mother certainly did. Although she had no clear idea of how or what was possible, I know that I never felt that she felt I was in any way betraying her or abandoning her in that regard. Whereas I think my father, but on the other hand, this was the man, this was the figure in the family I most identified with. My father regarded it any ambitions other than to live his a life exactly like his as a challenge, and I think he was defensive about that, which is not unusual, really, that kind of response, because it is, in a sense, it's a rejection. You're rejecting the model. You know, the father has done what he can, and he puts forward himself as a model, and then you say, no, that's not good enough. I want to do something else, something different. And I'm sure, I mean, as a parent, I can imagine how that feels. And my children, I'm sure, in different ways have said the same thing. No, that's not good enough. I want to do something else.
This is a personal question, but you were cross-eyed as a child, or you had an eye that was crossed as a child?
Does it show?
Well, I find
it wanders a little.
No, I find myself looking at one of your eyes and not the other.
Yeah, it's hard to look at both at once. Yeah, because one is cast,
Can you see out of your other eye? Or?
I can see fine, Just wanders around a little bit.
Was that something that you were uncomfortable about as a kid? I mean, were you self-conscious?
Self-conscious? Oh, sure. Yeah, I think so. Because it was much worse when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. I can see from pictures that it was quite clear, at least clear to me. Yeah. And it was occasional. You know, children are very quick to find the object that they can tease and the little access to power there. And so I'm sure, you know, it seemed much greater to me at the time than it should have or could have.
Were you born that way?
I don't know. I don't think so. And my mother says that I acquired it in the first year of my life, her explanation for it is vague, and so I really don't know.
What do you think? I mean, what are your fantasies about it?
Oh, that an angel kissed me. I know where you're trying to lead me, and I'm not going there.
Are you working on another book now? Is that
yeah.
Once you're done, then you're sort of ready for
it? No, I've been off this book for a year, and it takes a year between completion and publication, so that's the year where you try to resubmerge yourself and get on with another book so that when the book comes out, you're busy and you're fixed on this other one and you aren't so dependent on how the public responds to this one. It frees me from the reviews in a way. I mean, John Cheever, when a book came out, used to go to Europe and stay there for about 6 weeks and wouldn't come back until nobody was speaking about the book anymore. I understand the impulse. I just bury myself in another book, and I am writing a novel now. It's going to be I assume at this point a long novel it's a historical novel based on the life of John Brown, the abolitionist, who whose body lies moldering about 3 or 4 miles from where I live in New York. He's upstate New York. He was buried in the Adirondacks.
You feel his ghost?
You sure can. When the moon comes up over Mount Marcy, you can feel the ghost of John Brown, restless.
Russell Banks, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
Russell Banks' latest book is called The Sweet Hereafter. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
from Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowain with Fresh Air. As an investigative reporter and columnist at the Miami Herald, Carl Hiaasen writes about how tourism has ruined his state. As a crime novelist, Carl Hiaasen has set his new novel at a third-rate Florida theme park. Coming up, Carl Hiaasen on the dark side of the Magic Kingdom. And get ready to dance. World music critic Milo Miles has a review of the latest album from one of the Caribbean's hottest dance bands, The Burning Flames. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A warning today from President Bush that he will send U.S. warplanes to escort U.N. helicopters over Iraq if Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein does not comply with the Persian Gulf War ceasefire agreement. A White House spokesman said that U.S. planes will be sent in if Iraq continues placing restrictions on weapons inspections. With more on this story, Linda Fasulo reports from the U.N.
UN atmosphere was calm today amid reports of new military planning. The Iraqi ambassador described it as a tempest in an empty cup of tea, saying that the Security Council's concerns can be resolved. Iraq rejected UN helicopter flights last week and suggested a compromise, barring aerial photography and missions in the Baghdad area. It also restricted the missions to 2 weeks with no weapons carried on board. Now the French council president says the next step is a written response from Iraq clearly showing its intention to comply with UN demands. Western diplomats have said they would consider armed escorts for the inspections, while the Soviet ambassador said Moscow is at work trying to persuade Saddam Hussein to change his mind. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
On Capitol Hill, a compromise has been announced on legislation that would guarantee workers unpaid leave for childbirth and family emergencies. A bipartisan group of senators unveiled a more flexible family and medical leave bill that would exempt businesses with less than 40 workers. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
An earlier family leave proposal was approved by Congress but was vetoed by President Bush last year. The new bill, announced by Democrat Christopher Dodd and Republican Christopher Bond, addresses concerns raised by the White House and the business community. The bill sets aside 12 weeks of unpaid job-protected leave a year for emergencies such as birth, adoption, or illness of a family member. Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy is a key co-sponsor.
Senators' schedules are flexible. So I was able to be with my son Teddy in the 1970s when he was suffering from cancer. Management schedules are flexible, so chief executives and other managers get the time off they need for family emergencies. What's available to business should be there for workers as well.
Supporters say the bill would cost employers about $5 a worker each year. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
A strong earthquake hit Guatemala early this morning, killing at least 9 people and causing damage. The earthquake was centered about 60 miles southwest of the capital and measured 5.8 on the Richter scale. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 5 points to close at 3,017.89 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. The FAA says that it plans to talk to officials of AT&T in order to find out why a telephone system failure in New York City grounded air traffic for hours last night. A power disruption in New York City hit switching computers, causing long-distance telephone problems. At the same time, a number of airplane flights were grounded because FAA controllers were not able to direct traffic in and out of New York City area airports. Secretary of State James Baker is meeting with Syrian leaders in Damascus after speaking with Egyptian leaders in Cairo. The trip is part of Baker's latest effort to convene a Middle Eastern peace conference. Jan Ziff of the BBC has more on the story.
Before leaving Egypt for Syria, Mr. Baker held an unexpected meeting with the Saudi Arabian ambassador to Washington, Prince Bandar bin Sultan. Officials say the prince is on his way to Moscow, following the recent visit of Yevgeny Primakov to Saudi Arabia. Mr. Primakov was sent in the role of special envoy to discuss possible Saudi aid for the ailing Soviet economy. Here in Damascus, Mr. Baker is discussing the letters of assurance the United States has worked out with the participants of the proposed October peace conference. The official said that the content of the letters was not up for negotiation on a line-by-line basis, but that suggestions and comments would be taken into account. Also on the agenda is the plight of the Western hostages still being held in Lebanon.
Jan Ziff in Damascus. In Yugoslavia, Croatia's defense minister has resigned. Meanwhile, the U.S. is taking 10 of 15 U.S. officials in the breakaway republic out of the capital because of fighting there. Heavy fighting between federal military forces and local militia shattered a new ceasefire agreement that went into effect yesterday. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Carl Hiaasen's official bio says that he was born, raised, and still lives in what's left of South Florida. Hiaasen has worked at the Miami Herald since 1976, first as a reporter and now as a columnist. He's also written a number of detective novels. While his column lets him rail against greedy developers and corrupt politicians, his fiction gives him a chance to rewrite the news stories that come across his desk and give them happy endings. His new novel is called Native Tongue. It takes place in a familiar Florida setting, a tacky theme park.
You live in Florida and you write about tourism in the business industry in Florida, and you write about theme parks. Everybody and their grandmother's got a theme park, and of course Disney World is the ultimate theme park. And years ago I had gone and done some work on lawsuits that had been filed against Disney World because I thought it would be kind of funny to see what kind of things happen that we don't hear about normally at Disney World, which is sort of this hermetic Android, Stepford Wives sort of atmosphere. So I thought it would be fun to see what was really happening, and there were some fantastically funny lawsuits. And
like what?
Well, there was one that sticks in my mind. It was either Pluto or Goofy, and I get those two mixed up, so you'll have to forgive me. But it was during the Main Street Parade, which is like the culmination of the big festivities every day at Disney World. They have a Main Street Parade. All the characters come out, and Mickey and Minnie, everyone sings and dances. Well, I guess on this particular day, it was either Goofy or Pluto. It had a really, what you would call a bad day at the office, apparently. And he's prancing and dancing down Main Street, USA, and some little kid comes out and tugs on his tail. And the allegation of the lawsuit was that Pluto or Goofy then turned and drop-kicked the kid right across the parking lot. And I thought to myself, this is wonderful, because reality has intruded. I mean, that's the sort of thing I would pay to see as a tourist. I mean, forget the parade. That's funny. I mean, nobody was injured. I mean, there was some allegations that the kid was traumatized and that, he was going to grow up to be a sniper or something. But the fact of the matter is, it was just sort of one of many, many very weird, their people had expired, for example, on a couple of the rides. Now, you have to then prove were the rides the cause of the death or not. And I know that's not funny, but in many cases, there were not rides that you would expect someone to particularly die on. So I got some ideas from that. I thought, now, what if you had a theme park that wasn't as careful as Disney World? What if you had a theme park that was sort of a cut-rate Disney, where the engineering talent probably wasn't quite up to snuff with what Disney would have used? And that was my idea for Native Tongue and creating this theme park in that book.
I must say, from my limited experience in Disney World, it's the only city I've ever visited where I want graffiti and garbage.
Right, you do. You have this longing for some sort of, as I said, reality, something to happen that isn't planned, that's spontaneous, that's fun without being orchestrated fun. And that's why all of us who live in Florida, and especially people who live in Orlando, kind of get a little bit of a kick out of it when something happens at Disney World. I don't mean it's something catastrophic, but something that they can't control. A few years ago, the place was invaded by black vultures who had been moved out of their native habitat. And so, like everyone else, they thought Disney World looked pretty darn good. But, of course, black vultures don't exactly fit in with the Main Street Parade, sort of harmony. And there was a great scandal because some of the vultures were confronted in a rather violent way by Disney employees. And, But, to me, all of us in Florida sat back and laughed and said, okay, there you go, deal with that.
Well, you even say in your book that, or you seem to imply that Disney World is a much more insidious form of entertainment.
Well.
You write, well, let me read this. The mouse's sprawling, self-contained empire sucked tourists' pockets inside out. They came, they spent until there was nothing left to spend. Then they went home happy. To lifelong Floridians, it was a dream concept, fleecing a snowbird in such a way that he came back for more. Astounding.
Well, I mean,
are you speaking for all Floridians?
Well, I think I'm speaking for many Floridians because it is an incredible concept that people come, and Disney is so shrewd that they have taken care of, I mean, literally from the time you step off the plane to the airport, I mean, you are in their clutches, both emotionally and otherwise. And I mean, and they, the food, your hotel, if you want, your every form of transportation, if you want to play golf, there's nothing that you want to do that they can't arrange and that they'll be very happy to take your money for. And that, after all, is what the tourist industry is all about. So we in South Florida have always looked upon that strategy with great envy, because it seemed to us for a long time down in Miami and Fort Lauderdale that Disney World in Orlando was sucking all our family tourist business away. I mean, they had just literally drawn almost a line across the state below which tourists need not go anymore. And so there is sort of a jealousy and inferiority complex that we live with down there.
Your protagonist, Joe Winder.
Winder.
Joe Winder.
Yeah.
Is an investigative journalist who works in the public relations department at a rival theme park to Disney World called the Amazing Kingdom of Thrills, right, which is located in South Florida.
In the Keys.
Is that your greatest fear, that somehow, as a journalist, you're going to end up putting out cheerful press releases for some corporation?
There is a high burnout factor in journalism. There really is. It's hard to last a long time and keep your sanity and keep a normal family life and all that. And so in corporations, big ones, are always in the market for experienced journalists to come work in public relations, because journalists know how other journalists think and how they can be not just manipulated, but also to be made comfortable. I mean, if you know how newspapers and TV stations and radio stations work, then it helps when you're dealing with those people to have someone who with some expertise and background in it. So I think that for a lot of reporters, particularly with myself, with my background is in investigations, and for me to wind up in a place like that would sort of be tough on, I think, my pride and ego for a while, and that's what's going on with Joe.
Carl Hiaasen is my guest. He's an investigative journalist and a columnist for the Miami Herald, and he's written a number of novels. His latest book is called Native Tongue. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist and journalist Carl Hiaasen is my guest. You seem to be very attracted to rather convoluted plots. We have in this book an eco-terrorist. We have a blue-tongued mango vole.
An endangered species
stolen from the park. The president of the theme park is hiding out in the witness protection program. Winder's girlfriend is a phone sex operator. There's a roadkill gourmet. There's a kind of oversexed dolphin. What do you have against simplicity of storyline?
Oh, I think the story is simple. I think the characters are a little complicated. I live in a place where there are no simple stories, and so I don't write simple stories. I mean, nothing is as it seems in South Florida, so I'm not used to a simple linear storytelling mode. I mean, I put as many interesting characters as I can into the novels because I like people to be sort of intrigued and want to find out how did they get that way. I mean, how does a former governor of Florida wind up living in the swamp eating roadkill? And I mean, these are not just demented figments of imagination. They were all inspired by an event or a person or something that, you know, that really, really happened.
Well, I must say also in your novels that many of your characters meet strange and violent deaths. There is a killer whale that expires eating a park employee. A president of the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce is chopped up and put in a suitcase, strangled by a rubber alligator.
Well, that's just a personal fantasy of mine.
Let me go on here. There's a composting accident. There's a woman in a condo eaten by a crocodile. Is this a window into your fantasy life?
Well, I got to say that when in Florida, growing up in Florida and seeing it's a place of immense beauty and just incredible natural power, nature still has a pretty strong hand. And despite our best efforts to pave it over and neutralize it, that nature occasionally strikes back. And I always root for nature in those circumstances. When a crocodile comes in contact with a human being and does what crocodiles tend to do, which is eat, I have to say I end up rooting for the crocodile most of the time. It's just part of it is watching the encroachment and the disappearance of a place that was very precious to me as a kid and isn't around anymore. And so I sort of end up rooting for nature. I mean, I don't entirely fear the idea of a big hurricane. I think there are benefits to rearranging the skyline a little bit in downtown Miami.
Now, your critics say that you hate Florida, and that's why you say all these terrible things about the people who live there.
No, I love Florida. I just hate what they've done to it.
Well, I know that you grew up there. You're probably one of the few people that can say you were actually born in Florida. You only live a couple of doors from where you did grow up,
right,
outside of Fort Lauderdale. What's the Florida of your youth?
Well, it was still a place where you could, you know, get on your bicycle if you were a kid, and literally I was within riding distance of the edge of the Everglades, You go out there and you fish and you catch snakes and critters and you, as far as the eye can see, you see nothing but swamp and nothing but green. And now you see nothing but concrete. And I don't think that's an experience that's unique to Florida by any means. I get letters from people all over the country who've read the books who have experienced the same pain and the same sick feeling in their gut when they go home and they see something that's happened in their hometown to a place that they had fond memories of. There's nothing unique about the experience, but in Florida, it is the predominant experience of people that have grown up there to see a change, and it's happened very rapidly and with great cataclysmic effects on the environment. To the point now that this is a state where the state mammal, which is the Florida panther, is now nearly extinct. The state sea mammal, which is the manatee, is down to the last couple hundred. The state fish, the largemouth bass, is inedible due to mercury poisoning. I mean, it's a pretty sad legacy. It's the kiss of death to make something the official state creature of Florida, I guess.
You have suggested that a hurricane could fix a lot of what was wrong with Florida, and the mayor of Miami demanded that you apologize to the entire human race for your words. Have you? Did you?
No, and I won't. And I mean, I'll include him in that particular category. I'll be generous today and include him. But no, I didn't. I don't intend to apologize. And what I said, in fact, was that on any given day, if you're sitting there in a bad mood, sitting in traffic on I-95, that you start to begin to wonder, you know, of the possible purging effect of a hurricane. And I say that because I think all of us who live in a little tiny tropical peninsula like that need to be reminded of nature's power occasionally, and to be reminded that we don't own this, we don't have a monopoly on this particular little beautiful stretch of America, that we are, you know, really holding it in trust for our kids and our grandkids and for all the generations to follow. And we've got to start taking care of it a little bit. And so I don't exactly have the same trepidation. I mean, I think I certainly don't advocate great loss of life, but I would like to see some of the architecture taken care of. But I think a storm could do that nicely.
Are you going to have to choose at some point between your writing as a journalist and your writing as a novelist?
Oh, probably, yeah. It just gets too hard to juggle. It's such two completely different disciplines, and the books are becoming more and more consuming, which is, I'm flattered, and it's wonderful, but there, at some point, I think either you go insane trying to do both, and there are very few columnists. I mean, Jimmy Breslin writes novels, and he writes nonfiction while he's doing the column. So does Pete Dexter. So do a few others, but it's a very hard thing to balance, very tricky thing to balance without completely running yourself into the ground. And I guess if I had to choose, you know, and I probably will someday, I'll probably end up writing the books. And the inspiration is I would miss, you know, I would miss being in the energy of the newsroom is tremendous. You're around talented people, some of them very crazy people, but nonetheless, it's a fun It's a fun environment, and you draw a lot of inspiration and a lot of ideas from that as a writer. And that would be hard not to have. But on the other hand, you know, there comes a point, sort of a saturation point, too.
Where do you go on vacation, since everyone comes to Florida?
Where I go? I try to go to Montana once a year, which is, you know, beautiful and largely unpopulated. I try to pick the states where the population's actually declining and then go there and float the rivers in Montana. I spend a lot of time in the Keys, which are still quite pretty if you know where to go, the Florida Keys, and you know where to go and you know where to hide. And I'm not just talking about the tourists, but from the general population increase down there. But there are enough islands to get lost in down there that if you've got a boat, you can get away from it. And I spend a lot of time down there in Everglades National Park and in that area. And there are still places to go where you will not see another boat the whole day. And that's kind of not very many places you can say that about.
Now, see, I would think people hearing you would say, hey, let's go to Florida, and you're going to get another whole packload of tourists.
Well, I think as soon as they get the first cloud of mosquitoes going down their clothes, they may reconsider, because there's nothing like an Everglades Park mosquito early in the morning to make you wish you were somewhere else.
Carl Hiaasen, thank you very much for joining us today. Carl Hiaasen is a columnist for the Miami Herald and the author of the new novel, Native Tongue. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us about the news today. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Marty. Today, our big story is the president's decision to send troops back to Saudi Arabia to permit U.S. fighter planes to escort U.N. forces as they try to determine whether Iraq is complying with the terms of the ceasefire. We have another piece in our series on affirmative action. This one is on race and politics and the effort to guarantee political representation to all races. And, of course, we're still covering the story in Yugoslavia, where despite efforts to impose a ceasefire at noon today, there is still quite a lot of shooting going on near Zagreb.
Thank you, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Listening to music from other countries isn't always easy. Sometimes it's so complex you have to strain to understand it. But world music commentator Milo Miles has what he deems a sterling record from the Caribbean that he says demands no more than moving your feet and shaking your shoulders.
It's very easy to describe Dig. It's a party album through and through. No bones about it, don't take no miss. The Edwards brothers played together as kids and eventually wound up as the backing band for soca star Arrow. Indeed, Clarence Edwards helped write the peppy soca perennial Hot, Hot, Hot. Records by Arrow always stood out because he deviated from the pure calypso beat and favored heavy rock guitar solos as much as horn charts. The best guitar commentary came from Toriano Edwards, and all the brothers seemed at ease with reggae, disco, funk, and salsa, as well as soca. In 1985, the brothers picked up nephew Watkins and went out on their own as the Burning Flames. Right away, they proved they could hit the bullseye without Arrow. Burning Flames favor a rapid pulse, almost at the speed of punk rock chatter, but I think their advantage lies in the intricate harmony arrangements directed by Clarence and Toriano, while soca, for the most part, is solo singers. It's clear the Edwards brothers were listening to Motown and the earliest Bob Marley and the Wailers as much as local talent. On Dig, the interacting voices turn alternately funny, sweet, and passionate. Dig was produced by a Florida threesome who call themselves the Jerks,
and who got famous tuning up Miami Sound Machine before Gloria Estefan went totally suburban. As is inevitable, preparation for the hoped-for mass American audience means the sound of the burning flames is rationalized a bit. The biggest loss is that Dig includes none of the utterly crazed and frenetic dance numbers the Flames tossed into their six earlier albums, such as the following. But none of the Flames' previous records was as consistent as Dig. They never managed a ballad that was as compact and endearing as I'm on Fire. And like every other track here, the rhythm hook bites deep.
I'm burning up deep inside.
Burning Flames are a single-minded outfit, determined to make you move with a smile. It's nearly the only music that can do it when the temperature sails past 95 degrees. About as deep as they get is the song If You Get What You Want, which tackles the same question the Shirelles posed way back when in Will You Love Me Tomorrow? Still, the vintage groups of Burning Flames most remind me of is KC and the Sunshine Band, the old shake-your-booty disco crowd of the 70s. If that reference makes you shout yuckaroo, the Burning Flames are probably not for you. The rest of us folks who have happy feet can dance in the fire and feel no pain.
Milo Miles is a freelance writer based in Boston. He reviewed the Burning Flames' new album, Dig, on Island Records.
If you get what you want tonight, will you remember me tomorrow?
Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and is performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
So true, I will never fool you. I start to dance with that cute little body. Then I push it close, right up.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The bookstores are filled with psychological self-help books. The public television schedules are filled with John Bradshaw specials. And terms like codependent and inner child are becoming part of everyday language. On the next edition of Fresh Air, writer David Reif takes a harsh look at the self-help movement. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you can join us.